This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. We're going to talk about the important events of the week. We have our panel of trumpet writers here ready to discuss all the good stuff that happened. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good afternoon.
We have Andrew Miller.
Great to be here.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
The Trumpet is a unique news source, and we look at the world through the lens of biblical prophecy. And not only does that help immeasurably in forecasting events, helping us to recognize the real trajectory of where today's trends are leading, but it's also really helpful just in recognizing what's important. A lot happens every week, and any show that aims to give the week in review in world news has a lot to choose from. But we focus primarily in four main areas, and we follow the main biblically prophesied trend in each of these theaters in the world: the rise of an Iranian-dominated power in the Middle East, the rise of a German-dominated Europe, the coalescing of a Russian and Chinese-dominated alliance in Asia, and the fall of the once dominant English-speaking nations of America and Britain. Several items on today's program are terrific examples of just how effective and how accurate that overview of the world is, because we're really seeing these trends being fulfilled in a very specific way. We're going to start the program in the Middle East. For 25 years, we've been pointing to Iran becoming the leader of a resurgent Islamist empire whose influence would reach across the Middle East from Afghanistan to North Africa based on those biblical prophecies. And an analysis came from Lebanon this week that basically says this is exactly what has happened. For this story, we're going to turn to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was really exciting to read this, especially in preparation for the Trumpet Weekly and this program this week, because as you said, it's something that we've been saying for such a long time, and now it's becoming common to see headlines like "The Iranian Empire is back." So this author, Hussein Abdul Hussein, he looks back on the historic Persian Empire. Of course, that was an Iranian empire, would be another name for it. And he said, quote, "For the first time since 625 CE or AD, Iran has restored its control over a contiguous territory that extends from the east of Afghanistan to the Mediterranean coast." So he's talking about all this land that we've been talking about a lot on this program, especially since the rise of ISIS, and we have Iran's troops going in there and its proxies going in there to fight against ISIS. You now have a situation where Iran does literally control territory across Iraq, into Syria, and then into Lebanon, reaching all the way up to the Mediterranean coast.
Some of the specifics that he draws attention to, you can fill us in on those things.
Yeah, so he's not actually talking about the fact that they have proxy governments set up in Syria and that they have Hezbollah necessarily in Lebanon. He's talking about a couple of actions that took place last week, one both in Syria and one in Iraq. The first being that Hezbollah was officially inducted into a new army, a new Syrian army, part of it's called the 5th Syrian Army, and this troop is officially dubbed as a storming force, and they're going to have Hezbollah fighters as part of the hierarchy in the Syrian army that will fight along with this new 5th Army in Syria. So you have them becoming part of the command structure in the Syrian army, and of course we know Hezbollah is a proxy of Iran. They don't try and hide away from that fact. They take their orders from Iran as well. Now, that by itself was interesting, but then exactly the same time this week, we had in Iraq legislation passed in the Iraqi parliament, which made the state-sanctioned Shiite militias a part of the government forces as well. So we've talked about them before and how they were needed, these Shiite militias that answer to Iran in the fight against ISIS in Iraq, because they were the most effective ground force and Iraq didn't have the troops to do it. So they were fighting already. But now, according to this vote, which gained support by, I think it was, 300 or 208 of the 320 members in Iraq's parliament, they said, yes, this Shiite-backed army that we used to say was a militia is now part of our forces, and they've given them basically a governmental stamp upon these armies that they don't fight for themselves anymore. They fight for Iraq.
And maybe you could just tell us how closely aligned these militias, these Shiite militias that we're talking about, how much this really is a representation of Iran's interests, how closely beholden to Iran these militias are, former militias.
Well, some of their leadership, if you're talking about the popular mobilization forces or their units, there's over 100,000 of these members, and a lot of them did retreat back into... Well, they did come from Iran, retreat back into Iran during the Iraq War when the United States was there. One of these people were the same people that American forces fought in Iraq, and they were obviously traced back to Iran as well. We know that they're funded. Now they're going to get more funding, obviously, from the Iraqi government since they're part of the government forces, but they were funded up to this point by Iran. And they also have a lot of their banners and their whatever they have stamped on their uniforms and the flags
insignias
that they carry.
They're
Shiite flags, and a lot of them have the supreme leader on them from Iran. Mm. They're not fighting for Iraq, or else they'll have the Iraqi flag. No, they're fighting for Shiites, and the leader of the Shiites is based in Iran.
Now, this Lebanese author, he actually points back to some more distant history that Iran is fulfilling here. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Yeah, the way that the Iranian Empire, or I'd rather say the Persian Empire, personally, the way that the Persian Empire developed and grew and how it was organized after Cyrus the Great. Cyrus the Great obviously came into power around 539 BC, and he developed this empire that then stretched out all the way to the Mediterranean coast and pushed down towards Egypt. And they ruled in a different way from the previous powers, in that instead of having necessarily their own rulers over each of the territories that they conquered or the kingdoms that they conquered, they set up their own satraps, they called them, the rulers over these provinces that were a lot of the time a local king, a local ruler that they allowed to continue ruling as long as they paid tribute and offered the leadership, the governing authority to the emperor in Iran or in Persia. And they called him the Shah and Shah, or the King of Kings, because he was over these other territories. Mm. It's not like you just had the bureaucracy coming from Iran itself. No, they outsourced that to the local kings as long as they obeyed orders from the King of Kings. And that's what we see. We don't see the Iranians themselves in Lebanon. We hardly see the Iranians themselves in Syria. And even a lot of these Shiite militias in Iraq, they are Iraqis. But who do they answer to? They answer to Iran. They're doing it again the same way. I would add that Cyrus the Great was a whole lot more of a benevolent ruler and leader than I think the current Iranian leadership is.
Right, absolutely. So this Lebanese author, he points to what Iran's next move might be, considering how much progress it's made in establishing this empire.
Yeah, he says they're basically done. Well, they're not finished in Syria, this land bridge to the Mediterranean coast there through Iraq and Syria. They'll still be there, and they've still got more to fight there. But they might draw their attention to other regions, particularly around the Gulf. We've even talked about how they would probably like to destabilize things in Bahrain. And then they're already doing some damage, obviously, in Yemen, trying to motivate another proxy down there. And he is right, this author, to show that they're going to look around the Gulf to exercise more power in a similar way that they've exercised it across Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. But he doesn't go far enough. Bible right. prophecy indicates that they are going to do that, as he says, but they're going to push further than Yemen, across even to Ethiopia, and then up into Egypt, and then across North Africa into Libya. Iran wants an empire, and they want an empire that extends even further than Cyrus, Darius, Xerxes, all of those did anciently, all those ancient leaders. They want to stretch all the way across North Africa, and that's Bible prophecy indicates that they're going to have a good crack at that.
Like you said, pretty exciting to see an outside observer putting the pieces together and recognizing just what's happening with Iran. And it is so perfectly aligned with what we've been saying Iran was going to do, and with the prophecies of the Bible that really show Iran's ambitions and how far it's gotten in realizing those, even in the world today. Thanks for that, Brent. We will turn now to Europe. One of the most important prophecies regarding our time today speaks of Europe coming together as a single empire. And years in advance, Herbert W. Armstrong foretold several specific things that have since taken place in Europe: the formation of the European Union, the adoption of a single currency, Germany's unification, Germany's rise to dominate the continent. Another very important aspect of the prophecies about Europe regards its rise as a unified military power. And so far, we've watched with interest, particularly in the last few months, as more and more headlines have been coming out about this from Europe. To give us the latest of these headlines, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, we saw another very significant step in this direction this week, and it goes alongside what we talked about a couple of weeks ago about Europe working on a unified military headquarters and reforming how it pays for its battle groups, etc. Now, this is a proposal by the European Commission, what we saw this week. It still has to be agreed by European countries. So what we talked about 2 weeks ago dwarfs it in a little way. That was absolutely huge, kind of a groundbreaking piece of news that we saw 2 weeks ago. This is very significant still, but not quite on that level. So the EU, what they're doing is they're looking at ways to spend more when it comes to procurement, when it comes to buying equipment, and when it comes to developing equipment. Now, this is typically something that's very, very controversial because, of course, say the Dutch want to spend money on Dutch arm companies. The Germans want to spend their money in German arm companies, the French on French, etc. And so they've never really been able to get together and buy things together, even though they would save a huge amount of money by doing so. They'd be able to fight alongside each other so much better by doing so. Because of this, everybody wanting to protect their national defense industries, and you can see why, that's something that is pretty important to protect. But because of that, they've never been able to take advantage of being able to work together on this. And they're estimating that the savings would be somewhere between $25 to $100 billion that they could make by Europe acting together here. So it looks like after this just being something that's been impossible, they're actually getting to grips with it. So there are two main proposals. The first is for a budget that would eventually rise to be $500 million that would be spent on research and technology. And so Europe would work together to develop things that they're lacking, like a European drone. Investing in things like cyber warfare is something else that's been talked about. And then the second part would be a 5 billion euro fund to buy new equipment. And again, this would be spread out, so buying as one through the European Union. And so the fact that they're moving away from protecting their own interest, I think that's significant. The other thing that's very significant about this is that 5 billion, the money that European nations put towards this 5 billion pool to buy equipment, that would not be subject to EU rules when it comes to government spending. And we spoke about this 2 weeks ago. That was another major part of what they put in place two weeks ago. And you know, Germany has a lot of influence with the European Commission. I think if they're proposing this, it's very probable that Germany has signed off on this. And so I think this is a real sign that Germany, you know, Germany has been opposed to this for a long time. France has been pushing for military spending not to be subject to those borrowing rules for a while now. And Germany has always opposed that because they want those borrowing rules to be very strict, because ultimately if a country can't pay its bills, Germany has to. So the fact that that German opposition seems to be disappearing is very significant. I think it shows a lot of German seriousness now, and they're willing to compromise with things they've not been willing to compromise before to make this EU military happen. And then this is something that France has wanted. So it also implies that somewhere Germany is getting something that it wanted when it comes to the European military. And we don't yet know what that might be, but that could be something interesting to watch for as well.
Just one by one, all of these obstacles that seem to be tumbling before this project as it advances forward. It's quite amazing to see that happen. And all of this is taking place very much with the blessing of the United States as well.
That's right. The New York Times said that they'd spoken to Mr. Obama's officials. They said that the administration officials welcomed the increase in spending. And they quoted an anonymous administration official saying, "It's no secret we've been asking them to do this for years." So not just met with approval, but the mood from the United States is, finally, we've been wanting you guys to do this much earlier.
Right. I'm sure that that's going to intensify under a Trump administration as well. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. As the world grows more dangerous, another trend that we're seeing in several nations, very prophetically significant, certain to grow even stronger, this trend, is the rise in strong populist-type leaders. We've just seen it in America. We see it in several European nations. It's certainly happening in Asia, in Russia, in China, and Japan. Later, we're going to talk about the Philippines. Well, this move toward strongman leadership could also be happening in South Korea. This nation has been mired in political scandal, and it looks like South Koreans are warming up to the idea of a pretty significant change in their government. For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the people of South Korea, they're growing more and more furious every week about the scandal that President Park Geun-hye is sort of bogged down in. They've been protesting against her for weeks and demanding that she step down. It's hard to say at this point whether she'll be able to finish her term in office or not. She has about 1 year left in her 5-year term. But whether she survives that last year or not, this scandal, like you said, is causing a lot of support to grow for a man who could be her replacement. And he's a man who's sometimes called South Korea's Donald Trump. And if support for him continues to rise, South Korea really could soon be led by this leader who is sometimes described as a populist or even a strong man. His name is Lee Jung-myung, and he's the mayor of Songmeng City. And he's been tapping into all kinds of anger among South Koreans over government corruption and lack of jobs and also family-run conglomerates, which tend to foster a lot of corruption as well in South Korea there. And basically, he's running on a platform that says business as usual has to end. And South Korea needs to make some pretty extreme and drastic changes. He denounces his enemies with really bombastic words sometimes. He arouses cheers from people who are just furious about usual politics. And also, like Mr. Trump, Lee uses social media to aggressively spread his ideas. So they get right to the population immediately instead of being disseminated out through mainstream media sources. And he's also often appealing to the strong anti-Japanese sentiments among South Koreans. He has said that President Park needs to be thrown in jail for her corruption. That really mirrors a lot of what we heard in the U.S. presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. I've got a quote here from Stephen Ward. He's a professor of political science at South Korea's Chosun University. He said, "Voter discontent with the establishment very well might be high enough to propel a populist into office on the protest vote. And Lee could be that person." So Mr. Lee really could become South Korea's next president. And maybe that's what South Korea needs in some ways right now to sort of extricate itself from this quagmire of scandal and other problems. But if he's elected, it would just mean that one more firebrand, populist-leaning leader is in power. And that is a growing trend that we see across the world right now. In Asia alone, you've got Japan's Shinzo Abe, you've got China's Xi Jinping, the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte, who we'll talk about in the second half, and then, of course, Russia's Vladimir Putin. So if Lee is elected, then it would make the world's 11th most powerful military part of this populist trend.
Well, it is an interesting trend. Seeing this play out in Asia, we definitely have talked quite a bit about just how important Russia and China are in marshaling the rest of Asia together. Just looked at from a standpoint of biblical prophecy, and in some ways it seems like you would almost expect these other Asian nations to be more conciliatory and just kind of getting on board. But this just... as the world grows more dangerous, you really do see this reaction and a kind of a nationalist reaction in so many of these nations. So it will be really interesting to see how that plays out. It just seems like overall things are becoming more volatile in reaction to what's happening in many nations around the world. Seeing this take place in South Korea, it will just be interesting to see how this, if he's strongly against Japan, for example, then,
right,
you know, how does the alliance end up gelling?
Yeah, it's hard to say. There are a lot of moving pieces with these types of things, but his anti-Japanese sentiment could end up making South Korea more conciliatory toward China. Mm-hmm. Possibly. Mm-hmm. You know, that could be one possible outcome of a change in leadership of this kind. But however it happens, though, it does seem like the deck is sort of being stacked with these men who are more prone toward nationalism and in some cases jingoism, the types of men who would be more prone to use military force to secure their country's interests.
Interesting stuff. Thanks, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story before the break, a story about America. One fascinating development that happened in America's presidential campaign was the way that Donald Trump exposed the biases and, in some cases, the corruption of the mainstream media. He really struck a chord with a lot of Americans, and trust in the mainstream press is at an all-time low. It looks like the established media are striking back, in a sense. They're branding a lot of news sources out there as fake news. Basically, with the rise of the internet, it's given rise to a lot of alternative news sources, and some of them are, well, they're pretty shaky, and some of them even publish intentionally false information. But what can be done about this? For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, yeah, fake news is definitely a huge buzzword you're hearing out there these days. Some sites, such as the Denver Guardian, they've recently outed as a legitimate and intentional source of disinformation, where they're basically just looking for clickbait. I think they famously published the headline, FBI agent suspected in Hillary email leak found dead in an apartment in apparent suicide murder, which got shared over 500,000 times on Facebook. And I don't know, It's totally false. I mean, it might be a little bit of an indictment on how the Clintons have run their political policies in the past, that there are 500,000 people who believed that without second-guessing it. Mm-hmm. But it was completely false. There's also, on the other side of the political spectrum, like stories complete with pictures that Donald Trump was born in Pakistan. And they've even got, like, this little orange child with blonde hair running around in the streets of Pakistan from... like 50, 70 years ago, but
maybe a different set of people who'd be inclined to believe that story as opposed to the Clinton story.
Right. It'd be a different set, but it is definitely something on all sides of the political spectrum. You're getting websites that are satire websites on purpose, like The Onion, websites that are purposely spreading fake news, like the Denver Guardian, and then some other sites that there's just a lot of controversy over. Is that true, or is that your opinion? I think even the website 538, which is normally well-respected as a statistical website, they got lambasted by a couple media outlets for spreading fake news when they said that Donald Trump had a 30% chance of winning this election. They said that was way too high. Huh. It turns out it was way too low. Yeah. But either way, that is just kind of something where you're wondering, like, is this legitimate news or is this fake news? Now, probably the concerning thing is at the least part, there are a lot of big companies like Google and Facebook who've come out and said that they're concerned about people who maybe voted the wrong way mm-hmm. because they read this fake news, so they want to try to censor fake news from their platforms. No more fake news on Facebook, no more fake news on Google. And as this Forbes article we've linked to in our Trumpet Weekly points out, though, as I said, to do that, you either have to write an algorithm that can identify fake news, or you have to hire someone to just go through manually and flag things as fake news. In either case, how do you do that? I mean, it's maybe the Denver Guardian, because an algorithm probably couldn't distinguish between the Denver Guardian and the Onion. Mm-hmm. One's fake news maliciously, one's fake news because it's funny. An algorithm. Now, a human user might be able to pick up on that nuance of the sarcasm, but even the human news user, if he's inclined to be a Clinton supporter and he sees that 538 saying that Donald Trump has a 30% chance of winning the election,
right,
things like that, you can't really know how to do that. And so far, I mean, I guess this isn't a government policy. This is Google, which is a private sector company. This is Facebook. This is a private sector company.
But they do have quite a lot of power, and there have been pretty high profile cases where their biases have been exposed as they've censored certain news outlets and labeled certain news outlets as fake.
Right. Because even though Google and Facebook have the legal right to run their company how they want to see fit, I mean, that is the risk, because they start flagging things as fake news that aren't fake news, and then all of a sudden Google becomes the world's biggest multinational billion-dollar fake news company.
Right, or certainly they're serving as the arbiter for a whole lot of internet users in terms of what is going to pass in front of their eyes.
Right. I mean, that's where I get most of my news, actually, is Google searches.
Full disclosure here.
Right. Google searches that you look for. I mean, I guess Google's not a news agency. You get them from other sources, but it is Google as the web provider that I prefer.
Yeah.
So it's – and it is just kind of something to where they're – it gets down to that. It seems like the best policy, and as probably when America was set up with the freedom of speech and the First Amendment rights, is that you just kind of have to trust people to be smart enough and discerning enough to be able to pick up on a charlatan site like the Denver Guardian for themselves. Because as soon as you have government officials or even huge media officials that decide to step in and do that work for you, you get all sorts of news stories that you're just never going to hear about.
Right. Yeah, really fascinating story with a lot of implications, and certainly it's of interest to us, who a news source that some people would look at and say, well, there you go, fake news. And we take what we do very seriously, and we strive for accuracy in everything that we do. But if you're feeding any feed through the lens of a liberal news aggregator, then you're going to have problems. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Libya is turning into something of a contested area between Europe and Russia, how the European Union is moving into Cuba, how the Black Lives Matter movement is actually defending the legacy of Fidel Castro, and how the president of the Philippines is threatening to kill human rights activists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
Russia and Europe are locking horns in a growing number of arenas around the world, in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, even in Syria and elsewhere. It appears one more area that could be a point of contention between them may be developing in Libya. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
A really important figurehead of the leadership of the Eastern government inside Libya, Khalifa Haftar, he traveled to Moscow this week, and he met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. It was his second visit to Moscow, to Russia, in about 6 months. And it's interesting that he's traveling there because he was, at least according to the news reports, he was requesting help, requesting armaments, requesting weapons to help in the fight, fight against terrorism. And we know that Russia has supported him before. Russia has given the eastern governments in Libya the ability to print money as well. And it's just, it's a warming relationship, which does spell a little bit of danger for the Western government in Libya. We've talked about this before on this program, but as a brief recap, after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi back in 2011, you did have the fracturing of Libya. Libya fractured completely. A bunch of different militias rose up, Islamist militias, secular militias. And as it's all settled kind of down, what you've had now is two rivaling governments that are kind of functioning each on their own, one in the east and one in the west. And then you've had ISIS in the middle of the country, basically. And we've talked a lot on this show about how the Germany and Europe have been trying to set up or really push this government on the western side. Even over the past year, they've set up a this government of bureaucrats there. It was pushed by the UN, mainly pushed by European nations, and it is deemed as the sole legitimate power of, according to the Europeans, of Libya, this government in the West. And yet the whole time you've had the House of Representatives that is based out of the East that are still functioning saying, hey, no, we're actually in power. We were voted in by the people, and yet they were deemed by the Europeans as illegitimate. Now we have Russia coming on the scene. And while they have been in support of what the UN and Europe has been doing in the West, trying to, in a way, just at least letting it happen, we see them supporting the arch enemy, really, of this, of the Western UN-backed government. This guy leading the army of that Eastern government is Khalifa Haftar.
So what's Russia's motivation in your estimation? Is this something that could really be viewed as deliberately trying to undermine Europe's efforts there?
I don't know necessarily if Russia is actually acting incorrectly here, even from a more moral standpoint, considering that that was the government that was elected by the people. Even when we come back to this government that was set up in Western Libya by the UN and Europe, they set that government up, and then about 6 months later, earlier this year, I think it was in July or maybe August, the UN voted to end the arms embargo on Libya just for this Western-backed government. Nobody else can receive arms apart from the GNA, the Government of National Accord, the Western-backed government. And at the time, Russia said to Europe, who pushed this end of the embargo for just this group, he said, I don't know what you're up to here, but you should make sure that you basically play it fair and ensure that you're including everybody and trying to include all of Libya, not just the ones that you want in power. And that's what they said back then. And now they're kind of moving with their feet, it seems, saying that we will help out that Eastern government because they are legitimate. And if it comes to it, we might consider sending them arms because they've been just such a good fighting force against terrorism in Libya. This Eastern-backed government and the Libyan army of Haftar, they've been very effective in fighting in Benghazi and elsewhere against ISIS elements as well. So Russia, I don't think, is necessarily doing the wrong thing here. I don't necessarily think they're doing it to counter Europe. But the end result will be that they are adding to Europe's problems if you have this rivaling government that is going to get arms from Russia. It's not going to help them out in what they want to do in Libya.
A lot of moving pieces here, because we obviously focus a lot of attention on Europe stretching into Northern Africa and the Middle East and its designs there, and just how that's going to play out according to the prophecies of the Bible. Also, the relationship between Europe and Russia is one that we're watching very closely, right, also because of those prophecies. So the tension between them as it affects an arena like this, definitely something that will be interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I think another thing to consider is another country that hasn't supported the GNA, the Western-backed, European-backed government in the West, that's Iran. They have refused to accept that government as being representative until the government in the East signs off on it. They said we're not going to support that government until all of Libya comes together. So you have this trifecta again, or at least the trifecta being Iran, Russia, and whichever power they want to support. In Libya, right. It is this guy Haftar. In Syria, it's Assad and so on and so forth. And in Egypt, it looks like both of them are supporting Sisi as well. So Iran is definitely a player to watch there, another one that is anti-Western-backed government in Western Libya.
Anti-Europe, and again, right. Another alignment between Iran and Russia, which seems to happen more often than not, where those two seem to be lining up with one another against European interests. Thank you, Brent. Cuba's longtime dictator Fidel Castro died last Saturday. One trend that has been going on for quite a while that could well accelerate now that Castro is dead is European investment in Cuba. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is something that Voice of America News brought to attention to this week, and that is just how much even European investment into Cuba has accelerated already. And not just investment, but also just political rapprochement. Europe has been very quick to draw close to Cuba. They started working on warming up relations just a little before the Pope brokered this warming of relations between Mr. Castro and Mr. Obama. And so now what we have been seeing is just a flood of European countries into Cuba. So this article talks about how French companies are set to revamp Cuba's international airport. Germany's opening a trade office. Unilever is building a 30 million soap and toothpaste factory. Spain has become the island's second largest trading partner after China. Of course, the European Union, when counted as a bloc, is a bigger trading partner for Cuba than China is. It talks about how many delegations are going there, how much tourism is increasing from Europe. So we're seeing a lot of that already. And the speculation is that, yes, once you've got Fidel Castro and then probably once Raul Castro, because he's quite old as well, once those two have both died and you have new names without that, the big kind of controversy that comes with that Castro name, some more lesser known faces in there, and Cuba moves become a normal nation, that this is just going to heat up. But then the other speculation is that, well, if Mr. Trump takes the step back and says, okay, well, we're going to pull American businesses out of Cuba, doing the reverse of what Mr. Obama is doing, then Europe might see that as a major opportunity to get into Cuba without any American competition.
And European investment, European incursion into Latin America, and particularly as close as Cuba is to the United States, this is something that we've watched with quite a lot of interest for some time because of its relevance to biblical prophecy.
Right, and this is something American presidents used to watch very closely for quite some time. I mean, this was, of course, the Monroe Doctrine is the famous statement about America. And Britain, who very quickly supported the Monroe Doctrine, would not allow any new powers to gain footholds in the Americas, any new European powers. And then Theodore Roosevelt, you look at how vigilant he was in enforcing the Monroe Doctrine, watching economic ties that nations like Germany were building with Venezuela, for example, and how those economic ties were being transitioned into military ties, or in that case, military missions to go and get debt paid back. This was something that he watched very closely, and for good reason, and presidents have watched since then. So it's something that, this is America's backyard. America's oceans provided a huge benefit in terms of security. And so America's usually been very vigilant to make sure that other powers aren't allowed to come close to its shores. And now Mr. Obama has said that America is no longer going to enforce the Monroe Doctrine. And just about nobody is at all alarmed by Cuba's warming up now to the rest of the world.
And Europe, of all powers, is one that the United States doesn't seem to view as any kind of a threat whatsoever. But again, if we look at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, we know that there is a whole lot to be alarmed about. there are specific prophecies about a coming economic besiegement of the United States that Cuba could play a huge role in helping to fulfill. Gerald Fleury has written about that. You can look for that, the Deadly Dangerous U.S.-Cuba Deal article for some of that history online at thetrumpet.com. Well, thanks for that, Richard. Fidel Castro had a horrifying record of oppression. He held power with an iron fist for over 50 years, and yet many people are reacting to his death by praising him. We talked about this on our Wednesday program this week. One particularly interesting advocate of Castro emerged this week. That is the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, since about probably February, I think, of this year, the Trumpet's really been tracking Black Lives Matter's evolution into what really amounts to a revolutionary Marxist group. We drew attention at the time, our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, did, about some of the praise that leaders of Black Lives Matter had for Ashada Shakur and Huey P. Newton and some of these other Black Marxist revolutionaries from the 60s. And then in August, we did a piece about the movement for Black Lives and their platform calling for nationalization of banks and nationalization of businesses and a minimum income and a lot of things that are really just drawn, almost look like they're drawn directly from the 10 planks of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. Mm-hmm. So this has been something that's unfolding for some time. But even this shocked me even this week when I went to the official Black Lives Matter's Twitter account and they've linked to an editorial, unsigned editorial, just signed Black Lives Matter, but linked to their official Twitter account entitled Lessons from Fidel, Black Lives Matter, and the Transition of El Comandant. Mm-hmm. And it basically is an editorial praising the legacy of Fidel Castro and trying to take lessons from his life that the Black Lives Matter movement can use to implement their vision in America. And I guess I'll just read one of the opening sentences.
And they're not talking about praising the healthcare and the education system in Cuba. They're talking about his methods of accomplishing what he was able to do.
Right. Well, they do definitely mention the healthcare and the education system, but then they also do mention the Cuban Revolution as mm-hmm. well. And that's, I guess I'll just read this couple of the opening statements here just to kind of really show what I mean there. It starts out, it says, although no leader is without their flaws, we must push back against the rhetoric of the right and come to the defense of El Comandante. And there are lessons we must revisit and heed if we will pick up the mantle and changing our world as we aspire to build a world rooted in vision of freedom and peace, and that comes only with justice. And then a little bit down, it says, from Fidel, we know that revolution is sparked by an idea, by radical imaginings, which sometimes take root among just a few dozen people coming together in the mountains. It can be a tattered group of meager resources like in Sierra Maestro in 1956 or St. Elmo Village in 2013. And obviously they don't elaborate on those two events. They kind of are assuming that their audience is just going to know about those. But Sierra Maestro in 1956 is where the Castro brothers returned from their exile in Mexico. It was a mountain range where they got in and gathered a band of about 80 or so revolutionaries and launched the revolution that ended 4 years later with the communist takeover of Cuba. Mm-hmm. St. Elmo's Village in 2013 is where about 30 or so black students and activists gathered after the shooting of Trayvon Martin to launch the Black Lives Matter movement. So they are comparing this. They're equating these two events. They said, we launched our movement in St. Elmo in 2013, and that's just like when the Castro brothers returned to Cuba to launch their revolution.
Amazing. So I guess we'll just keep on watching. It's amazing, though, that the Black Lives Matter movement really is a mainstream movement. It's been praised publicly by President Obama, several other public leaders and politicians. And for them to have this blatantly communist revolutionary type language and to be advocating these kinds of actions. Shocking.
Right. And hopefully within the next not too long, I've got an article written that's being currently edited that'll be up on our website soon that goes through pretty much the entire breaking down pretty much the entire editorial, because that's probably not even the most shocking statement I read to you right there. And it really ends almost on a very poetic note about how the spirit of Fidel Castro has ascended into the realm of his ancestors and is watching over the Black Lives Matter movement and guiding them for their future vision for America. And I mean, this is, they mentioned this, no man's without their flaws, but I mean, this is a guy who locked up one out of every 18 Cubans. I mean, Joseph Stalin, on a percentage basis, Joseph Stalin wasn't that effective, and killed, or at least killed or created circumstances that killed almost 100,000 people.
This isn't going to end well. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We talked earlier about the populist trend in Asia, and one of the most colorful and concerning examples of that trend is in the Philippines. The rule of President Rodrigo Duterte is raising eyebrows for a number of reasons. And for the latest of these, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, on two or three previous Trumpet Hour episodes, we've discussed the drug war that Duterte has been waging and how he's authorized the killing of thousands of drug users and drug traffickers by vigilantes and police in ways that ignore the law of the land there. And one question that's often come up in these discussions is, who's next? You know, if a leader decides to bypass his constitution and the law of the land to try to solve one issue, then what would stop him from doing the same thing with another issue? If he's willing to kill drug users in extrajudicial street killings, then what other groups might he circumvent the law in order to target? Well, this week, Duterte gave an answer to that question. He was giving a speech about his drug war, and he started to talk about human rights activists who criticize his illegal killings. And then he said that he would kill human rights activists who stand up against him. To those activists, he said, "I will include you in the killing because you are the reason why their numbers swell." So that was a sobering statement. It's possible that it was largely bluster. Duterte is prone to bluster. But given his track record, though, it's still making a lot of human rights activists in the Philippines really nervous. You know, no one wants drug abuse or all of the crime and misery that accompany these issues to continue in the Philippines. And it is admirable for a leader to really tackle a problem with the kind of focus and force that could actually solve it. But the real question here is about being above the law. You know, Duterte's willingness to ignore and break law to tackle narcotics, it just creates a slippery slope. So if he would kill human rights activists who criticize those extrajudicial murders, then who comes next? You know, alcoholics, maybe bad drivers, Sabbath keepers. We don't know who it would be, but the trend does make me think of the famous poem by a Lutheran leader who spent 7 years in Nazi concentration camps. His name was Martin Niemöller, and his poem is just really critical of the Germans who refused to stand up against Hitler's purging of group after group from German society. We often hear about Jews, but Hitler also tried to wipe out drug addicts, beggars, Jehovah's Witnesses, mentally ill people, and activists like Niemöller. So his poem says, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." And you know, he wrote that after spending all those long years in those terrible camps. So maybe Duterte is half joking with his threat to kill activists, and maybe after the drug users are killed, his purge will be over. But it's still a sobering trend, and just something for us to keep a close eye on.
Thank you, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. We compile all of these stories together into a report each week, and you can receive it in your email inbox for free. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of other news from all our panelists. It's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Richard.
The Netherlands is gearing up to be the latest country to ban the burqa. The lower house of parliament, they basically passed a law that would ban any face coverings, including motorbike helmets, but basically it's aimed at this Muslim face veil that covers the face, from government buildings, and I believe that would include schools as well. Now, we'll have to see still if that gets through the upper house, but it could be another step now in the clash between Europe and just Islam in general.
Now over to Jeremiah.
In a comparison of math and science results for middle school students, Asians win again. The Trends in International Maths and Science study is published once every 4 years, and the newest one came out on Tuesday, and it said that Asian nations continue to dominate the international scene in both maths and sciences. And this studied more than 600,000 students around the world, and the highest ranking were Singapore, Hong Kong, South Korea, Taiwan, and Japan.
And now over to Brent.
OPEC has agreed to its first oil output cut since 2008. The decision on Wednesday came after Saudi Arabia agreed to a big hit on its production and dropped its demand on its arch rival Iran to slash its output. The decision pushed up crude oil by about 10%. Fast-growing producer Iraq also agreed to cut some of its booming output as well. And also Russia came together with OPEC to make this decision as well, that they would actually slow down their output as well. According to Reuters, OPEC produces about a third of global oil, or around 33.6 million barrels per day. And under the Wednesday deal, it will reduce output by about 1.2 million barrels by January 2017. About half of that hit is going to be taken by Saudi Arabia. And of course, Iran will be allowed to continue to increase their oil output at will.
Let's go to Andrew.
A Somali-born student injured nearly a dozen people in a car and knife attack at Ohio State University last Sunday. After intentionally ramming a car into pedestrians, the student took out a butcher knife and began slashing. Federal authorities say the attacker was likely inspired by a slain Al-Qaeda operative and the rhetoric of the Islamic State. The attack did end after a university police officer pulled a gun and shot the attacker.
We'll go now to Richard.
Italy has a major referendum on Sunday. Just about all the news analysts here over in Europe, they're holding their breaths. It's on constitutional reform. However, if it is blocked, the Prime Minister Matteo Renzi has said that he will step down. So he'll resign in the case of a no vote. His main opponent wants Italy out of the euro. If he does step down, it's likely that the banks will completely freak out. So Europe could head into just a major, major outbreak of the euro crisis starting on Sunday.
And back to Jeremiah.
India is the fastest growing economy in the world, with a growth rate of 7.3%. Data released on Wednesday said that India's economy has slowed slightly from 7.6% in the July-September quarter of 2015, but it's still pretty far above the nearest competitor, which is China. So the fastest growth in the world is still happening in Asia.
And back to Brent.
Israel's Minister for Public Security, Gilad Erdan, said on Wednesday that 40 to 50% of the fires that broke out across Israel last week were the result of arson. He said, quote, "These estimates are based on facts. When you see two Molotov cocktails with flammable materials and you see that the fire started from there, you understand that this is arson. And there are a number of cases like this," end quote. There are about 40 significant fires around the country and in the West Bank from November 18th to 26th. And collectively, they were being called by some as the Fire Intifada. As of Tuesday, police had arrested at least 35 people on suspicion of arson or incitement to arson.
And over to Richard.
The Bishops' Conference of the European Union, a group of bishops that generally pass on advice and things. They don't have any official role, but they pass on their input to the European Union. They're launching another push to make Sunday observance law. The EU wants to put out some more social regulation over the next year or so, and the Bishops' Conference has responded with their recommendations. And remember, the Pope was recently awarded the Charlemagne Prize, which is a prize for contribution to European unity. So what the Catholic Church says here does have some weight. And one of their five recommendations was to make it law that everybody has Sunday off work. Those of you familiar with what we've been saying over the years would know that this is a key prophecy that we're looking to be fulfilled. And so that's definitely something to keep watching.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
United States Border Patrol Chief Mark Morgan testified before Congress this week about the dangers his men are facing on the Mexican border. He pointed out that over 7,600 Border Patrol agents have died in the line of duty since 2006, and the number of deaths has increased 200% this year over last year.
I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. And we would like to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. Everything that we talk about on this program, we compile into a report that you can read. There's this news and a whole lot more. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
See you later.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you the words of Robert Louis Stevenson. Don't judge each day by the harvest that you reap, but by the seeds that you plant. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.